This is Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. You ready to go on a little trip and expand your mind? I'm not just talking about popping magic mushrooms for fun. There are a lot of folks who have a lot of data about the psychological benefits of psilocybin.
It's absolutely incredible that something as humble and inconspicuous as a little brown mushroom could change human consciousness, could make people more creative, could heal them.
That's from the Netflix show, How to Change Your Mind. If Governor Gavin Newsom signs a recently passed bill in the state legislature, pretty soon you may have the chance to experience magic mushrooms for yourself legally. Supporters see it as a chance to scale down a fraught and failing drug war and even trigger a major therapeutic revolution. Opponents, however, say magic mushrooms and other plant-based psychedelics are dangerous, and even those on the fence worry that the bill might be moving too fast without fully considering potential consequences. Mary Carrion is a freelance journalist who covers psychedelics. And Mary, thanks for coming on and talking with us about it.
Hi, Steve. It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Describe the basics of this bill. I mean, what's the difference between decriminalization and legalization in this case?
So it's interesting, actually. The language in the actual bill does use the word legalize a lot. However, when you kind of get into the nuts and bolts of this language, specifically in SB 58, it's more or less a decriminalization bill, because what it's technically legalizing is the possession, obtaining, preparation, and transportation of specific earth-grown psychedelics. What it does not legalize is the sales of these substances. So in other words, if you are, you know, selling these drugs, or you are trying to open a dispensary and sell them in your dispensary or something like that, it's still technically illegal to do that.
That's confusing to me, because it's like, how do you get them then?
Well, that's kind of the thing. So it gets a little slippery, in my opinion, around the language there. They also use the word obtaining. Like, how does one obtain a substance if you are not buying it in some way? So there's a chance that also is going to lead into a loophole kind of situation where, you know, maybe someone is going to buy like a painting for $200, but with the painting, you know, you're also getting some product as well. So we're going to see potentially how this SB 58 ultimately works out. It's still, you know, completely undefined as of right now. The regulatory framework has not been defined yet. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on a regulatory level to determine how the framework is going to look.
Yeah. So if you go and buy that Degas, you know, maybe taped to the back of it is a Ziploc bag of magic mushrooms. Is that
but
what we're
talking
about?
Yeah, potentially. You know, and this whole concept comes from cannabis. It comes from the cannabis world. And in some markets, that's kind of how it's been, specifically like in Washington, D.C. You know, people will buy soda, or they'll buy, you know, like a case of Mountain Dew. And with the Mountain Dew will also come an eighth of cannabis. So...
This bill, Senate Bill 58, which passed, by the way, I think it was 2114, mm-hmm. right? And there were some changes made, I believe, over the course of the session as well. This bill only decriminalizes so-called natural psychedelics. So tell us a little bit about the difference between natural and synthetic, right? And why is that? What drugs does that include?
So SB 58 includes psilocybin. It includes psilocin, both of which are active compounds in magic mushrooms. It also decriminalizes DMT, which is the active component in ayahuasca. And it also decriminalizes mescaline, but only a specific type of mescaline. It only decriminalizes mescaline from the San Pedro cactus. And what it does not decriminalize are compounds such as LSD, MDMA, and it also does not decriminalize ibogaine.
This bill, Mary, saw support from mental health advocates, including military veterans as well. Why are psychedelics seeing such support in those communities? I mean, the military isn't exactly a, you know, free love group of hippies. I think there could be some benefits, right, for people suffering from PTSD.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. There have been a lot of people, including veterans, specifically veterans, just because that is a community that has dealt with having to endure the throes of PTSD and, you know, excruciating pain and depression and anxiety that often comes with that condition. And a lot of military vets have experienced profound relief from using psychedelics, but, you know, not using them necessarily recreationally per se, you know, not using them and then going out and drinking and having a party in that kind of way, but using them in a ceremonial or therapeutic context. And then afterwards, kind of as like aftercare, they microdose to help them sort of maintain that place in their mind, that place in their heart, and kind of keep them in on the path of feeling better, managing those symptoms of PTSD, depression, anxiety, and helping them kind of live a life again.
A lot of Republicans were against this bill. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And some moderate Democrats were also against the bill. Why?
You know, it's all a matter of the drug war. And I think that people are finally opening up to the fact that research says that this stuff can help, that these medicines can help dramatically. And there are some people that don't see it. There are people who are worried that this is going to become a slippery slope into allowing our kids to have access to these substances, addiction, etc.
Well, I mean, that's a real concern, though, Mary, right? That is a real concern.
It is a real concern. And I believe that with the right education and the proper care in the law, proper frameworks, proper regulation, you know, our children aren't necessarily going to be exposed any more than they typically would be in a society that uses drugs. It's more than just psychedelics that we have to worry about on our kids' high schools and everything. It's stuff like fentanyl. It's other drugs that you purchase, that you can purchase off of social media, like fake Xanax or fake Oxycontin or something, and, you know, kids don't even know what they're taking. A lot of it has to do with education. A lot of it has to do with the regulation around these drugs as well. And the drug war does not help any of this. It doesn't help the educational aspect of it at all either. You know, ayahuasca isn't going to be on high school campuses. Middle schoolers are not going to have the ayahuasca tea, you know, walking around. That's completely unrealistic. But there are other drugs that are not in this bill that will totally be on high school campuses and or middle school campuses. So I'm not really sure these substances per se are the ones that we need to be worried about.
All right. So the 64,000 mushroom question is Governor Gavin Newsom going to sign this bill? He has until what? He has about a month, right?
Yes, he has until, yeah, he has a month. He has pretty much exactly a month, almost to the day. And, you know, it's 50-50. I've been hearing things both ways. Here's what we know. We know that Newsom says that he's against the drug war and he's publicly criticized it. What we don't know is his position on psychedelics. He also says that he's in support of harm reduction, but he also then vetoed a bill last year that would have established safe drug consumption sites. So it's, you know, it's hard to tell one way or the other what he's going to do. He also has not even made any sort of statement about this bill being on his desk. So we'll see how it goes. A lot of people are hopeful. There are also some critics saying that they don't necessarily think it's going to happen because of his, you know, presidential candidacy or the potential for it.
Which he has denied. But for the record, he has denied, I believe, on national television several times.
Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, politics is always a moving target, right?
So yeah, it is. It's definitely a moving target.
Okay, so if he does sign it into law, do we expect to see, you know, dramatic growth in the use of psychedelics?
I think that it will be a lot more accessible to people than it is right now, for instance. I think right now there's still a lot of curiosity about where to get these things. I think that there's a lot of question about, you know, if these things are safe, etc. I think that the educational aspect and the awareness of everything is going to increase dramatically. I also think that specifically in regards to mushrooms, yes. And I say that specifically because mushrooms are the most accessible out of all of these substances here that are laid out in SB 58. You can, under the law, you can grow them at home legally without getting in trouble for personal use, of course. You're not supposed to grow enough that you are, you know, making yourself available for moving a bunch of weight or making a bunch of sales. It's supposed to be for personal use.
Well, it's like marijuana, right? Marijuana is the same way. Yes. You can have, what is it, like 6 plants or something like that of a certain size. Yeah.
Yeah, there are possession limits to all of these and growing limits to this whole bill. And that's kind of what makes it function. And that's what makes it appealing to, I think, people in our government here. The fact that there are limits, it's not just a free-for-all kind of situation.
Right. And you won't see like a bunch of, you won't see a bunch of like spore stores opening up, you know.
Right. Yes, exactly. I do think that mushrooms are going to be the most accessible of all of these substances here because we can grow them. They're already kind of proliferating around Los Angeles and in Southern California. Like, we are in the hub here in Los Angeles of mushroom culture. And I think that's only going to grow, and this bill will only support that. So access is going to increase. People will be able to find them easier. And I think the education around it will also increase, and people are going to have the ability to kind of try and care for their mental health in ways that maybe they weren't before, and that in the way that traditional mental health care wasn't able to give them.
It's all up to Gavin Newsom right now. Mary Carrion, a freelance journalist who covers psychedelics. Mary, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Still to come, there's a new exhibit kicking off later in the week that features art made on Tongva land, the people who lived in what would eventually become known as Los Angeles, how that art is a lens into the past for centuries and connects with the present right now. That's yours after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. No matter what you think about modern-day Southern California and how it came to be, before LA was LA, this was Tongva land, a place that encompasses much of now Los Angeles County. And the indigenous people here made a ton of art over the many years they held this land. Well, now Occidental College is having an art show and retrospective that focuses on much of the art made by the Tongva and how it's influenced and resonates in the art and history of current-day Los Angeles. With me to talk about this new exhibit are its two curators, artist Mercedes Doramy. Welcome, Mercedes.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Artist Joel Garcia is also with us. Hi, Joel.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Mercedes, let's start with you and the title of this exhibition, The Iridescence of Knowing. Tell us more about what that's meant to encompass.
A lot of this exhibition was about breaking down some of the hard lines that we like to put around contemporary art, historic art, cultural practice, traditional practice, or even the borders between us as Tongva people and the surrounding tribes that also have intertwined cultural narratives or experiences or even literal intermarriage. And so the idea of iridescence was actually something that Joel came up with as a word. And the reason why we found it really applicable and interesting was because it's this relationship between a viewer, a substance that creates this kind of iridescent surface, and the light. And so as you move in relationship to the object and the person and the light, everything shifts. And in so often that when we think about how we want to contain or define what it means to be indigenous, what it means to be Tongva, there's so many personal experiences and family stories and intertwining with this place and the land that we inhabit that we wanted something that kind of echoed this flexibility.
You've actually included different generations of your family in this as well. So, I mean, let's talk a little bit about, you know, your connection to this land, right, and your family's connection.
Yeah, so I grew up in Los Angeles. I have lived away from it, but it's always been home. And that's a complicated thing as a Tongva person because, you know, you feel really connected to a place, but there's all these layers of history and time and colonization that kind of dissects you from it. And so I've always been in this space of looking at that relationship and being here. And, you know, for better or worse, my family is really full of artists. Both of my sisters are artists. My father went to art school. My mom is not a practicing artist, but is very artistic. And we make really different work. We have really different sensibilities, even aesthetics and mediums. But a lot of the roots of it is about, you know, how I described living here, being here, belonging here, but also being told that you don't belong. You know, it's not just my father that's multi-generational in this. There are other elders involved, L. Frank Manriquez and Craig Torres. And one of the things I really wanted to include that we talked about a lot was the people who generationally came before me, who really made the space for me to exist in the world where I can make art as a, you know, as my full occupation.
Joel, Mercedes gives you props for the title, Iridescence of Knowing. When we say the word iridescence, I mean, what does it mean to you? I mean, you're a community organizer. It seems like, you know, a lot of the things in your art making is sort of, you know, about putting things together, things that are, you know, interchangeable in this community, in the history of what is now L.A.
Yeah, I would also say kind of undoing things, too.
undoing things.
Yeah, so as a non-Tongva indigenous person living here in L.A., I think for me, it's been but also being disconnected from, I grew up in East L.A., being disconnected from so many different things. I think the work that I've done has been to bridge both people and understandings. And so like Mercedes mentioned, like, you know, you do work with street vendors and how you approach the idea of identity shifts. When you do work with, you know, folks fighting against displacement, those same realities around place and being and how you look at land and how you connect to the land shift as well. We get caught up in conversations, you know, about race in a very particular way here in Los Angeles, that we forget too how class informs our reality in Los Angeles. So to me, the title, like for the work that I do, for the work that Mercedes's elders have done, like Craig and others, they've had to learn how to do those things in these different spaces, so that folks like myself and Mercedes can have more room to create, build understanding, and push things forward, even if it's just a little bit.
Mercedes, if you're going to this show at Oxy,
yeah,
you know, on Tongva land, right, what are you going to see? What kind of art are we talking about by the indigenous people of Southern California? Are we talking about pottery? Are we talking about weaving? What are we talking about?
We wanted to really span this idea of traditional practice, like weaving. There are two Tongva baskets that are part of a collective that is recreating, remaking, re-understanding what it means to be to make Tongva baskets. So that would be considered a very traditional form. This idea of a basket informed a lot of our thinking about the space because essentially our baskets are coils. And so that starts in this very tight center and kind of moves outwards and expands upon itself. And when I think about the work in the show and how it connects to each other, I feel like it's in that same way, that there's Something in the people I know who make art in the Tongva community, that there's this deep research vein. Like, we are always researching and trying to parse through the historical documents and the records and the oral histories and the traditions, you know, that's always part. Now, sometimes that comes out in a very traditional way, and sometimes that comes out in an oil painting or something that's more in the a graphic design or a video piece. So I feel like this kind of core is present in all of our works. What does it mean to be connected to or reconnecting to our culture and our being in this place? But also, what does it mean to kind of have the breath and the air to kind of expand on that and to imagine? And so, you know, we have traditional baskets. We have images of baskets that are... there's this beautiful piece by Gerald Clark that's all made in stamps, of these really beautiful words like survivance. And then you kind of go out into painting. There's a map that was commissioned actually for the show that shows an overlay of Tongva villages onto an LA County map that was made by my sister Adrian. And so there's really different iterations. And I think what I'm hoping people come away with is this idea that we're a vibrant community that are actively working, that we're trying to give the viewer entryway, an invitation, but also a provocation to know us, to not kind of think of the Tongva people as something that exists in the past or in a history book or as a lesson or is relegated to this space of before.
And seeing it from the outside, Joel, not being a part of the Tongva community, but being a part of the indigenous community writ large, I mean, is that what you take away from it when you do this exhibit at Oxy College?
When indigenous people come together, whether it's for the first time or even in like seasonal gatherings, one of the first things that we do is reintroduce ourselves. And, you know, from those protocols, we've come to understand and learn about land acknowledgments. But that's just a small sliver of what those protocols entail. So me living here in Los Angeles, understanding the lifeways of the Tongva community, understanding the lifeways of Southern California Indians is an important part of showing me how to live in a place like Los Angeles that gives us so much already. This is, you know, one of the creative capitals of the world, if not the creative capital of the world. And we don't have the infrastructure for artists here in Los Angeles overall to really be able to grow from that, much less the indigenous community, even more so the Tongva community. So for me, this exhibition is a kind of a form of practice of those protocols, of learning to get to know one another, so that we understand our struggles, we understand how we look and thrust ourselves into the future as peoples, whether it's, you know, this vast spectrum of communities, Japanese community, Chinese community, Mexican-American community, et cetera, but also as a society together. So I think folks coming to this exhibition, I think it's an important part for them to learn where we're rooted at and who's also helping us drive what we become as a city, as a county, as we're also trying to figure out how to reconcile with the impacts of race and colonization. So I think for me, it's a beautiful way to kind of begin that conversation.
The Iridescence of Knowing, by the way, opens this Thursday, day after tomorrow at 6 p.m. over at Oxy Arts. It'll run through November 18th, I believe. Joel Garcia, Mercedes Doramy, thank you both for coming on and talking with us about it. We appreciate it. Good luck with the exhibit.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And that's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, there's a break in the heat, thank goodness, in the coming days. But some folks who work in the kitchens and warehouses, they don't get much of a break. And they're hoping the federal government will force their employers to give them longer breaks and AC to get cool. That's tomorrow on Greater LA. Join us anytime online at kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us how you're doing. Share with us a story idea you might have. Of course, you can get the podcast too, won't you? By searching KCRW Greater LA wherever you get your podcasts or at the website kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Zeke Reed, Celine Mendiola, Phil Richards, John Meeks, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel and Christian Bordahl all help make the show happen. I'm Steve Chiathakis. Thanks for being with us this evening. Have a great night.